You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Good afternoon, everyone. Charles Moskowitz here. Thanks for joining me. And my guest is William Ramsey. William is the host of his own program, William Ramsey Investigates. He is the author of several interesting books. I'm looking at some of these titles with really great covers, I must say. Children of the Beast, Aleister Crowley's Shadow Over Humanity, Abomination, Devil Worship and Deception in the West Memphis Three Murders Case, Prophet of Evil, Aleister Crowley, 9/11 and the New World Order. William, thanks for joining me today.
Charles, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
William, let's first talk a little bit about who Aleister Crowley was. My understanding is that he had a huge impact on the kind of the New Age movement, on the counterculture. You know, you had a lot of rock figures. Who, I think he made his way into the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Jimmy Page is a big fan. I think he lives in his house, right?
He bought his house, that's correct.
Yeah, he bought his house, Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, he's a major figure in the counterculture, so I think we need to understand who he was so we can get a handle on some of the aspects, some of the darker side, certainly, of the counterculture. So who was Aleister Crowley?
Yeah, there's a complex answer to that question, but he was born in 1875, died in 1947. He was born in close to Stratford on Avon, where Shakespeare was born, in a town called Leamington Spa. He was the only son of a very wealthy family that made money through breweries. So there was Crowley Ale and these things back in the 19th century. And his father died when he was 12. He was brought up in a very strict Christian sect. They were called the Exclusive Brethren. And they were really a subset of the Plymouth Brethren and a guy by the name of Darby, who is kind of famous for creating dispensationalism. So the Crowley household was very, there was Bible readings at the dinner table, and the dad was actually an early pamphleteer. So he would take his son around while he was handing out pamphlets for the Exclusive Brethren. But they thought that they were very special, and so he grew up in that environment. And after his father died, he kind of slowly drifted away. He was very bright. He was able to enter into Cambridge. So he went to Cambridge, right? He went to private schools as well. So he went to these, they would call them public schools in the UK, but they were kind of elite schools for the wealthy. So he was the beneficiary of an excellent education. And that's really how he started. But something happened to him where he became interested in occultism. And he said that he was going to try to be, you know, one of the, he was at Cambridge. He was in this kind of hallowed ground with all of these other great thinkers. And he set a path for his life where he was going to be among one of those great thinkers. So that's really where it started in probably 1895. He had really three interests. He was an excellent chess player, but he also was a mountain climber. So he had this kind of adventure spirit based upon one of his idols, who was Sir Richard Burton. If you remember, Sir Richard Burton was one of the few non-Islamic people to go on Hajj. So he traveled to Mecca and Medina under a, fake pseudonym and different messaging. So this was a guy who Crowley emulated during his life, was Sir Richard Burton and his writings. And Sir Richard Burton was a voluminous writer, and that was something that Crowley emulated as well. So what really distinguished Crowley is he just became interested in the occult. He was part of this early, he was a Mason, but he was part of an early magical group called the Golden Dawn. So it also involved other luminaries such as Yeats, the famous poet, William Butler Yeats, and
great
other
Irish poet. Yeah.
So really famous poetry, and they actually kind of had a squabble, Crowley and Yeats. It's kind of a famous, there was a famous confrontation over a staircase that there was really issues within there, like any other kind of magical fraternity. It seems like there's all kinds of infighting and stuff like that. So the Crowley was infighting with them.
A lot of competition. And William, I think that the occult goes back in England to maybe the modern first big occultist was John Dee, who was an advisor to Elizabeth I and who had some strange Kabbalistic approach. He was sort of he began a magical odyssey that that I think ran in elite circles in England from that time forward.
Yes.
And maybe Crowley wanted to kind of cozy up to that. He wanted to be a part of that. Sounds like he was involved with the elite circles.
Yes, only a really, he was kind of, I would say he was really an elitist. I think he was very classist in a very class conscious country. He did not really ever mix with, he wasn't one of these kind of sympathers or people who would cross class boundaries. He only hung out with the wealthy upper class. He never really had to work. Mm-hmm. He had when his mother died, he inherited, I think it was an incredible sum of money, which would equal $20 million today. So he had a sizable amount, but he just wasted it away. But John Dee's very important because Crowley integrated his kind of Enochian magical system into his magical practices. So Dee had this magical tracing board. He had his own language. He had something called the Aethers, which is a weird word, but it's kind of like you do these different, it would be like a dimensional chant. Aether is A-E-T-H-Y-R. So a lot of Don G was very influential into Crowley, and that was kind of one of his famous kind of excursions to Algeria involved John Dee. So he saw, you're right, he did see himself as this kind of person like that. He was also very influenced by another person by the name. He translated a lot of his stuff. He was known, his magical name was Eliphas Levy. He kind of took a Hebrew-sized name. His real name was Alfred Lewis Constant, who was kind of a fallen Catholic priest, but he died. Eliphas Levy kind of traveled around and went from France to England, and he died in 1875. So Crowley kind of actually felt like he was the reincarnation of Eliphas Levy. So there's now,
Was there any intersection between Crowley and the Theosophy movement and
very
Helena
much so.
Blavatsky and Ossoff and all of those people?
Yes, very much so. So he saw them in some ways, he learned from them, but also saw them as rivals. He admired one of Blavatsky's works and integrated into his magic.
Isis Unveiled?
Well, she did Isis, but there was, I think it was The Voice in the Silence or something like that. It was a short work she did. But they actually, some of the followers of Blavatsky's became rivals with Crowley later on in life when they tried to create the Maitreya with Jiddu Krishnamurti, who ended up in California.
Krishnamurti, who was supposed to be the earthly messiah and the inheritor of his movement. I actually interviewed these people. It's this Benjamin Krem.
Right. Oh, interesting.
I didn't get the Maitreya. That's right. I didn't get Krem on, but I got one of his assistants, and they kind of have carried on the movement that was started by Blavatsky and went through Alice Bailey and on to the Lucis Trust, which changed its name to it actually was originally the Lucifer Trust.
Right.
And
well, they had an art, basically Blavatsky had a magazine called Lucifer. So she, with
the
all
Dark
the,
Angel. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
So I think that, you know, this has always been something that's been the habitus of the elites and of the very, very wealthy. This kind of belief. I mean, it's theosophy, it's scientism. We could do you've done some fascinating research on the history of this. What basically did they believe in? I mean, they certainly seem to me to be anti-Christian and anti-God for sure.
Yes. Yeah. I think that it was kind of their political class. I believe that they were very kind of evolutionary was fine by them because it justified their kind of authoritarianism and their wealth, this kind of evolutionary thing. So Crowley kind of saw that way. I think they saw themselves very classist even across the pond, Curley spent World War One in New York City hanging out with very wealthy people. But they weren't Christian, not all. Curley was a very anti-Christian and wrote many tracts. One was called The World's Tragedy, which the world's tragedy is Jesus Christ. And he really engaged in very, very vicious statements against Christ, such as his lover was John, that his mom was raped by it's very graphic, raped by Roman soldiers. So that's how Christ, you know, that was the, so the story of the, you know, divine incarnation was not actually a Roman rape. Yeah, so it gets really bad. But yeah, so he really was anti-Christian, but I think that he was actually trying to create his magical system to be, to overcome it. So he called like this aeonic change, the new aeon, the old age, new age, but he used the term aeon. So the new aeon would be the aeon of Horus, as opposed to this other god. And it was all of his whole thing, like the birth of the child would be this new creation, this new anti-Christian psychosphere worldview. And that would be, you know, them. And he actually had a very feudal view. He actually thought that the aristocratic revolution was the ideal society. So like that is Crowley without any egalitarianism. And you kind of see that snobbery all running through occultism as well, where they're kind of like a special elite and all the other slaves shall serve. Crowley had a pretty strong racial animus. Even he had like one third of
his Blavatsky had that too. They believed that, I mean, and this goes right to Darwin.
Yes.
The idea that some races are more evolved than others. I mean, Darwin actually believed that the English were more involved than the Irish. And, you know, I mean, it was very, you know, in a way it's really the obvious manifestation of Darwinism, that some people and some groups would be more or less evolved than others. I mean, that would be the logical conclusion of his particular theory. And Blavatsky had really is the mother of some of the Nazi crackpot.
Right. Aryanism.
Race theories. Right. Yeah, you bet. Right.
Yeah.
She coined the word Aryanism.
Right. And I think Hitler had her, one of her books on his bedside. Like he was absorbed in all of that and also her move into German occultism as well. So Hitler was involved in that as well.
So there's this whole magic movement in Europe that Crowley seems to have been one of the major Pied Pipers of. I mean, he seemed to, maybe because of his writing ability and his ability to promote himself. So we really need to get a handle on what it is that he believed in, because the influence of that is very profound on our society. We get that he was anti-Christian. Probably more the motivation in terms of wanting to tear down the ministry of Jesus was because the ministry of Jesus embraced moral and ethical principles, right?
No question.
Immutable principles that go all the way back to Sinai.
Yes.
And that their whole idea was to overthrow conventional morality as some kind of a superstition, as some kind of a binding of man from his true nature, which would be something that would be almost supernatural. I think it also reminds me a little bit of the teaching, at least what I've understood, of Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Illuminati, which goes back to 1776. And right. His whole doctrine, and this is classic history in Europe. I know when you're in the United States, we sound like we've got tin hat on when we talk about this stuff. But this is standard in Europe. Everyone knows about this. Winston Churchill wrote about it. That basically his idea was to abolish all clerics, all sovereign governments, all government altogether, and replace it with this kind of indescribable, you know, new order that where everyone would revert to some kind of a primitive natural state. And that, you know, while he went underground after he was exposed, the documents that were uncovered about him, which were republished by John Robison, who was a Scottish mathematician and professor, and also by Abbe Barrowell, who wrote Roots of Jacobinism, that he wanted to, his method was to infiltrate Masonic lodges, which were otherwise fine, and use them on the inside through their secrecy on the inner core to implement his plan through subversion. Right. Now, it seems like, I mean, certainly I think there's evidence that Karl Marx was employed by them, because he wrote the Communist Manifesto and he was paid by this very shadowy group called the League of the Just. Who were they? Right. You know, was that Weissop's group after he was exiled? Possibly. But it seems like Crowley also embraced the basic theories that were promoted by Weissop originally.
Yeah, so, no question. I think he integrated a lot of them. He actually had one of his grades was E-popped, or like Pope, E-popped, E-P-O-P-T of the Illuminati. So I think that was grade, the eighth grade, that he had 11 grades. His numerology 11 was very important. But even George Washington wrote about Adam Weishaupt in some of his letters, referenced them and the French Revolution.
Said that it was diabolical.
Yeah. He said he have no doubt it existed. He didn't doubt it existed. So.
Oh, yeah. No, that letter is part in the Library of Congress. So you're right. Yeah.
So
he responded to a someone who asked him about his own lodge in Alexandria, which apparently he rarely attended and he wasn't involved in. And he said, look, I know about this. I don't think it's infiltrated my lodge, but I don't doubt that it's here.
Right.
And I don't doubt that it has influence in the United States.
But I mean, I think Crowley, in one aspect of his life, he was an aggregator. So he was aggregating wisdom from Western occultism and even Eastern occultism. So yoga, Hinduism, the I Ching from China, all of these different things he would just integrate into his overarching thing of a kind of self-perfected man kind of idea. And,
right. The perfectible. I mean, it's one world religion.
Right.
One without God, quite honestly, and without Christ.
Well, I think in Crowley's thing, if you look at Liber 77, man is God. So it's a direct rebellious statement of, and it actually kind of goes back to even going back to Genesis, you know, ye shall be as gods, the temptation.
Sure. The Garden of Eden.
Right. So
this is the temptation of the serpent.
Right. So Illuminism is definitely part of it. Definitely part of Crowley. And, you know, he saw himself as a magus, whether he's self-appointed, but like, Crowley was very bright. He was that's what really distinguishes him from other occultists, is that he was a hard working. I think there was one analyst of Crowley who said he had kind of a Puritan's mentality of hard work for occultism, which is very rare. So that's why he had so much writing.
That doesn't surprise me. A lot of energy. He looks very athletic. I want to bring it up to today. I mean, how did he get that kind of influence? Was it because he was able to infiltrate Masonic lodges, or did he have his own organization? How did that work?
Well, I wouldn't say that the OTO, so he became the head of the OTO, which is a German secret society. He started his own called the Astrum Argentum, or the Silver Star, referencing the moon. But he had, because I think he had this corpus of referenced information, that's really was it. And so the distillation of his idea is man, total freedom, and drugs and sex. And that was part of the, I think, the aspect of his ideals or ideology, was that it involved sex magic, which the OTO had. I think that was very attractive, and also anti-Christian. So people of that bent, a counterculture, it kind of fit in. So you have people like Timothy Leary, Robert Anton Wilson, very familiar with Adam Weishaupt, other, you know, Jimmy Page, like you said, Ozzy Osbourne, even David Bowie was a huge Crowley fan and wrote about Crowley. So many of these people, the known people in the counterculture, knew it. And Leary actually thought he was carrying on the work of Crowley, which is a remarkable statement, because this is a guy who was very much in almost like a Zelig figure, where he was with all these different people, wealthy people, the Hitchcock Mellon clan, the people around John F. Kennedy, friends with Aldous Huxley, right? So Leary was an incredible figure, and in some ways it was easy for him to carry on that work if he knew Crowley. So
the work involved here was in a way it goes back to the ancient Epicureans in Greece, whose sort of ethos was whatever feels good is good. There's no past, there's no future, everything is in the present.
Right.
If it feels good, it's good. If you think it's true, it's true. And, you know, this is a group that was criticized vigorously by not just Plato and Aristotle, but also by the Talmud, which refers to that as Apocorus. Anyone who is an Apocorus is an apostate, is a sinner, because it runs completely contrary and the opposite of the moral and ethical precepts of Sinai. It's, in a sense, an attempt to overthrow and uproot those precepts. The other, of course, the Jewish figure that followed this was Shabtai Zvi, the false messiah. That's a whole different subject.
Right, where Frankism. Right,
Frankists and the Sabadians, they subverted Judaism in many ways. You know, it's a very big subject. It's something I've worked on.
But I think they're similar to Crowley in that transgression was powerful. So I think Crowley was very much involved in any transgressive behavior.
Do everything that's the opposite of what the moral code says as a way to bring out the messianic age, because man will sink to such a low level spiritually that he'll have to be saved by the Messiah. And that this was this was the same principle of Satanism, by the way. You know, if you look at the Satanic Mass, it takes the Catholic Mass and it does everything the opposite. The crucifix is turned upside down. The bread is defaced. You know, everything that the wine is something else. I mean, everything that you do is the opposite of what the Mass is, as a way to overthrow the moral and ethical precepts of the Mass and to pollute it, really.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, Charles, because Crowley, when he was in Russia, he traveled to Russia before World War I and saw a Christian ceremony there, an Orthodox Christian ceremony, and took that and created his own Mass called the Gnostic Mass. Which its headpiece was the primary event Crowley looks at is when he received this book called the Book of the Law. And that kind of mocks the Book of the Law in the Masonic lodges. But the Book of the Law was received by some being named Awas in Egypt, in Cairo, after he had been in the king's chamber in one of the main pyramids. But so the Orthodox Mass, he actually perverted that and had a Gnostic Mass. And you can see pictures of all kinds of people who were involved in that, like Jack Parsons, who was involved in JATO, the jet-assisted takeoff, L. Ron Hubbard. So Crowley's tendrils, that's why I wrote the book Children of the Beast, is because Crowley was known as the Beast, and he kind of integrated Christian ideas from Revelation, the Book of Revelation, the Beast, and the Scarlet Woman. And he tried to create magical children, and I think a lot of these people really were as magical children. L. Ron Hubbard thought he was carrying on the work of Crowley as well. Really, if you look at the death of Crowley in 47, the creation of Dianetics in 48, Scientology 1950, carries right on. And he and Parsons were involved in something called the Babylon Working, and they were trying to create this magical energy to, you know, suffuse the world. And in some ways, Scientology succeeded in that.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. And, you know, look, there's a reason why Crowley was as magnetic a figure as he was, because the doctrine is very alluring. It's intoxicating, actually. What it is, it's the same siren call that the serpent gave to Eve in the Garden of Eden. It's, you can be like God. You can overthrow God, basically, in heaven. You are God. You know, in a way, it's the, in a secular sense, it's the very philosophy of communism and Nazism. You know, you are, every day you descend from the top of Sinai and you give a gift to the world. You're the center of the universe. I mean, you know, it's appealing, right? Right. It appeals to the darker, right?
Right, absolutely. Who wants to be a God?
No,
right?
Yeah, they're knocking on your door and saying, come on out, you're God. Right. You know, it appeals to the darker side of all of us. And a lot of people succumb to that, especially people who are powerful and wealthy, because they are living in their own world. They don't have to toil, you know. Everything has been either been handed to them, or they've achieved a certain something, and they get this sense of omnipotence, like, well, now that I have this, I want to do something for the rest of the world. I want to change the world. And you know, they feel like they can, you know, are more enlightened. And literally the word enlightened comes from this, the light bearer,
right,
than the rest of us. And then I'm going to come in And I'm going to, you know, form associations with birds of a feather, with other people who think like this. And we're going to give our gifts to the rest of the world because we're great.
Right. We're going to create a new world order. Right.
Yes. And, you know, and that, let's face it, that was a big part of these incredible rock bands of the 1960s. I mean, I don't know if those guys really knew what they were stepping into. I think certainly the Beatles didn't. I don't think Elvis certainly did. I think it eventually took his life. But for whatever reason, and it's an interesting phenomena, they became godlike. They became so huge. And so successful and wealthy and famous. I mean, you know, I mean, one of the, John Lennon was always sort of a truth teller anyways. You know, he said, hey, look, we're more popular than Jesus.
Right.
And he would stand when they would go to a hotel and people would be, women would be fainting. And he would stand up in the balcony and he'd do a Zig Heil salute. I mean, he knew how to mock the thing, but they became almost supermen. They became like godlike figures.
No, very true. And that, there's a famous statement by Robert Plant of saying, I am a golden god. And Page himself was collector of all of Crowley's materials, his house in Boleskine, where he did this working called the Abramelin, the Mage, which is kind of an old European occult manual about how to raise demons. So Page himself, and then even Jim Morrison of The Doors, they're featured on one of The Doors albums over a bust of Crowley. So it suffused all these bands of all the, and Rolling Stone, all these guys like
Sympathy Mick Jagger, for the Devil.
Sympathy for the Devil. All these albums, like there were Saturn, these symbols, but they were in a movie called Performance, which I covered, that was directed by a guy who literally sat on the knee of Aleister Crowley because his dad was his friend. And so Performance was very influential. So right around that time, it was a very counterculture. You could call it counterculture. You could call it a cult or stuff like that. But Crowley, was right there. His ideas are definitely being bandied about. And even some of these really strange occult societies like the Process Church of the Final Judgment, they were reading Crowley. Mm-hmm. And there you can see them around the Manson family and these ideas. So,
and there was also, there was a connection, probably in Crowley's time, there was a connection to the intelligence community.
No question.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the CIA, the OSS, you know, this was, Timothy Leary was well connected to the CIA.
Right.
This was, Jim Morrison's father was right. CIA. I mean, this
right.
is
Gulf of Tonkin. He was involved in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which was one of the great hoaxes of the 20th century.
Tragedy.
The Vietnam War.
Cost, yeah. Millions of people died because of that.
That's
Millions
right.
of Vietnamese. Yeah. Terrible.
That's right. Exactly. One of the great lies. I mean, talk about big lies.
Yeah.
And so you have this kind of interconnecting. I think that obviously one of the biggest examples of an occult leader and one that they all learned from would be Adolf Hitler, of course. And, if you research how Hitler was able to do this, there was a lot of psychology involved in how to manipulate people's emotions. You know, Hitler was very practiced at how to speak, where he would start out very slowly and he would build and he would have gestures and he would, the way he presented himself, that's something that's studied by, whether they'll never admit it, but, you know, people in power today, you know, it's obviously under the rug, but those rallies that he would have, it would appeal to and capture all of your senses. You know, they would have bonfires and it would be dark with flashing strobe lights.
Right. Wagnerian. Yeah.
Wagner played on the loudspeaker and you would be caught up in this sensational movement where you would forget yourself. You'd lose yourself and you'd be wrapped up in a spiritual, in his case, satanic public event where you'd have women fainting and, you know, women having sexual experiences, let's just say, you know, as he would enter the stage. And this same phenomena and these same tactics were used by these big rock bands, I'm convinced.
I think you're right.
In the 1970s, Led Zeppelin is one of them. And I'm not here to criticize their music either, which I love mostly. But, you know, I mean, we're talking about the cultural element of it.
Right, yeah.
And they used those positions to introduce the occult into mainstream culture. The Beatles certainly did, right?
Stairway to Heaven is a heavy-duty occult song. It's got all kinds of Masonic references. It's got references to paganism. Kenneth Anger called it the most satanic song he'd ever heard, and this is calling from somebody who is a huge Crowley follower. I don't know if you know Kenneth Anger.
But I've heard of him.
He, I think it was Hollywood Babylon. He wrote that book about all the scandals of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But he was very influential to Martin Scorsese and things like that. But I'm glad you brought up Hitler because I devoted a chapter to him in Children of the Beast because a lot of his ideology, I called Hitler a political Crowley. So Crowley was much more of an ideologue trying to create cultural change, but Hitler at certain points decided to become a politician, but all these ideas, success is thy proof, is right, is like an axiom right out of Crowley. And he had this one book Hitler did by Schertl. It was a tremendous loss for humanity because they could have seen what Hitler was reading, and he read a book every night. But some of his library survived, and one was by a guy by the name of Schertl, who had a book very similar to Crowley's title. His famous, most famous book is Magic in Theory and Practice. And I think Schertl's book was Magic, Theory, Practice, and something like Religion. It was almost a almost like Crowley lifted the title from Schertl. But you can see Hitler is writing and scrawling in the margins and reading this book in detail. And the book that remains, I think it's at Brown University, shows that he's leafing through it and looking through it. It's pretty remarkable. But there's very similar. And also what's really odd, you go back to the intelligence. I think Crowley was probably working for MI5 and MI6 right from when he came out of Cambridge. So right when he
And that was, Cambridge was a breeding ground for them, as was Oxford. And Hitler himself was supported by the intelligence. He was certainly supported by international banking.
Right, no question. But
that's a whole different subject. But
even Crowley's,
after the war,
right? Yep. Even Hitler's first step into the NSDAP was as a intel liaison to the military, right?
Exactly.
So plus, he started off,
and there's always been more than rumors that he was originally a communist. But after the war, you know, because we were talking about intelligence, there was the Operation Paperclip. Right. Operation MK Ultra. A lot of this stuff was declassified in the 70s, thanks to the Church Committee hearings, where these people that were operating with Hitler came either to the United States or to Russia or to the Soviets. And they were part of the whole intelligence apparatus. They launched a lot of things inside the United States, human experiments. You know, they were the ones who put LSD out on the street. You know, you had psychiatrist Louis Jolion West handing out LSD in Los Angeles.
Gottlieb.
Gottlieb
was his name, another guy.
Okay,
that was his,
yeah.
It was his fake name, but he used,
I think one of them was the personal doctor for John F. Kennedy.
Right, so that's Jacobson. That was Dr. Feelgood, right?
Exactly. And they were introducing the idea of what Aldous Huxley called the international chemical concentration camp. We would all be in an altered state of consciousness. We would all be controlled, whether we knew it or not. And we'd all feel happy, you know, come on down. So the 60s, there's no question that they launched this. The Beatles, as much as I love the Beatles, they legitimized drug use. They made it glamorous. They made it exciting. There are a lot of people that I know who are dead now because of that. You know, they were influenced.
A lot of people didn't make it. A lot of people did not make it.
That's right. And
mentally or physically or spiritually, yeah.
Of course they didn't. I mean, when you remove someone's, you know, you get someone hooked on a very highly concentrated substance, their life is in danger. Plus, you've removed the sense of the core spirituality. You know, it's like you lose your sense of life. So you have this moving into the late 60s and 70s. Heavy metal music had a lot to do with it. Talk a little bit, William, about your book, Abomination, Devil Worship and Deception. Now, you talk about a specific case here, but how common has that become? My understanding is, and I forget the name of the author, but I interviewed him years ago, and it's a very chilling book, that there was a satanic cult in the United States that was behind the Son of Sam murders.
Right. Maury Terry was his name. Maury Terry.
Okay. Yeah, very
Ultimate Evil was the name of the book.
Thank you. What's going on with that? I mean, is that part of Aleister Crowley's thing? And where are we with that in this country right now?
Well, it's tough to say. But if I could just finish off, just one interesting thing about the 60s is Crowley, we were talking about earlier about how he's going to create this Age of Horus. I think sometime in the 30s, he said, the ideal time, I think, for this birth of the child will be in the 1960s. So he predicted that this kind of explosion in occultism, drug use, free love would all happen. And in some ways it did. So, but as far as the Process Church, we mentioned that earlier, it's an offshoot of Scientology. They were supposedly one of the main groups behind Son of Sam. I do not believe Berkowitz acted alone. They actually had
signs.
So they had signs and insignia. They actually, as we talked about, or I mentioned earlier, Eliphas's levies, magical black magic insignia was in one of the letters that was sent to, I think, I can't remember the journalist's name. I think he was the guy getting all the letters in New York at that time. But so they had the cult elements to it. And so that process church actually was headed to Bismarck. And then there was a cult-related murder of a young woman in the Stanford church.
Yes.
Her name was Arliss Perry. And that's how that book started out. And it exactly. just, I think that Maury Terry was just trying to show that there was a multi-jurisdictional connections between a lot of this stuff. And I think even Berkowitz mentioned that he verified some of the stuff. He just didn't want to go into detail.
The author went to the prison and sat with Berkowitz and talked about it. And Berkowitz said, yeah, this is, I was part of a satanic movement and it's still going on. These people are still out there and they're still doing it.
Yeah, so, it's dangerous. And he said it was dangerous for him, if I remember correctly. He didn't want to really divulge a lot. But he had mentioned that he was in the occult. He was in a park in New York where they did all kinds of weird rituals. And there were overlaps with the Process Church, who always had German shepherds. A lot of German shepherds were this kind of standard dog. They actually opened Best Friends Animal Society in Utah for some strange reason. But
it's a front group.
Front group, right. So it's like an intel thing. So just like early.
They early have their businesses. Yeah, they got to make a buck at some point.
Sure. So, I mean, that's not uncommon, right? But
yeah.
So as far as the Process Church, Margaret Terry, but the West Memphis 3 is pretty interesting. It's a very well-known case. There were three documentaries made by HBO called Paradise Lost that really kind of ginned up a lot of public interest in this case. It happened in 1993. 3 8-year-old boys were found horrifically murdered in a ditch. On June 3rd, 1993, three young teenagers were arrested. Jesse Miss Kelly, Jason Baldwin, and Damian Echols. Real name, birth name was Michael Hutchison, but he was the oldest of them. Well, he was 18, so he was over, you know, he was an adult by law. The other two were not. There was very occultic bad things associated with the deaths. The kids were tied up from wrist to on the right side, right wrist to right ankle, left wrist, left ankle. Two of them after the medical examiner took a look at the files. Two of them were drowned, so they were alive before they were thrown in the water. So really horrible stuff. There was a trial, and they were found guilty. There was a he was given the death penalty to Damian Echols. The other two were given life sentences. But then this kind of whole cause celeb element started building up because of these documentaries that became interested in things started there was, in my opinion, an intentional clouding of guilt of the three. And they started saying the stepfather, and then there was another stepfather, and it led to the release of these three guys, who were guilty, in August of 2011. It's almost 9 years ago. And they actually pled guilty using a plea called an Alford plea, which the Supreme Court said that you can publicly claim your innocence while pleading guilty at law. So they're currently guilty at law. They were under probation for 10 years. They have one more year of probation. But it also involved all these celebrities. There was a huge celebrity kind of groundswell of support. Johnny Depp, very known, well-known actor. The Dixie Chicks, a guy from Pearl Jam by the name of Eddie Vedder. All these people raised money.
And they were supporting these three guys?
Correct. They were supporting the convicted people. I think that, like I said, there was a very strange change. But what it turns out is, like, the reason I got involved in the case is because Crowley was brought up at the trial. So I saw this video online where they're asking asking Damian Echols, who's on the stand, do you know a guy by the name of Aleister Crowley? And I'm like, oh, that was involved in this case. They actually, the prosecutors had a copy of Aleister Crowley's Magic and Theory in Practice on their desk while they're asking him. So they're asking him things. And Crowley specifically said, it's horrible, but for the ultimate sacrifice, it's a young male of perfect innocence around 8 years old. So it's like you're seeing this almost like carbon copy of the actions with this book and that's the danger of these writings, is that somebody 7,000 miles away from London could pick them up and, you know, try to act them out or try to be the next Crowley. So,
To become a made man, you have to commit a murder, and then the result is that the dead person's spirit goes into you. it's kind of comes goes back to the ancient assassins or the medieval assassins.
No, it gets really dark. The West Memphis Three gets super dark. There's all kinds of strange occult connections with these people. Damien Eccles has stated that he's been a member of the OTO, so it was Crowley Secret Society. And he just said this year that he was a member of the AA, which we talked about earlier, the Astrum Argentum. So that, which that society isn't even a group. It's just a repository of knowledge, and you find somebody who's in, and you become an acolyte of that person. So he's your master. It's just a one-on-one. He teaches you everything. So Damien Eccles is now like doing web series and stuff like that as a convicted child killer, a literal convicted child killer, but also still kind of a celebrity. I mean, he's been on planes with Peter Jackson, who did all of the Hobbit and Fellowship of the Ring books, the Tolkien books. So it's a pretty remarkable case if you really see the truth, but there's a lot of lies involved. That's why I titled my book Devil Worship and Deception, because there's occultism, but also a lot of deception surrounding what the real story of this. And Damien Eccles has covered his whole body in occult tattoos and really, I think, proven himself. He actually made an admission, and you can listen to, I've done some critiques about his public statements, but he said, "I was prosecuted for my love of the knowledge of Aleister Crowley." So he said that after his release, which is pretty remarkable. So it's really a kind of a very well-known truth.
Yeah. He was punished for the practice of his knowledge of Aleister Crowley.
Well, you said that, not me. But, yeah. That case is actually a very well-known true crime case, kind of a saga in the United States. And there's a lot of deception around it, in my opinion. That's why I wrote that book, because I included a lot of the court documents and just let people read through and show, like, this is what was going on. There's a lot of bad stuff going on.
So the thing that's also interesting about it is that these three guys got a lot of support from the entertainment industry. Let's just put it that way. And that kind of dovetails with stuff that I am seeing now. I don't want to mention the name of the group that is exposing it because I don't know who they are and I don't necessarily endorse them. But there's a lot of things going on around on the internet that claim that the elites of not just Hollywood, but even of our business class, et cetera, are involved in a cult of pedophilia and possibly satanic practices. Now, I'm not here to say that's true or not. I have no idea. I'm just some schmuck in Boston. What do I know? Right? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think Epstein was really shown a light upon how that class works. And actually, it's pretty interesting because that same attitude, I think, Epstein did is very similar to Crowley, where they're elites, they fly over the issues of things, they don't have to work, they have a completely
connected
different...
Connected to intelligence,
have occultism. There's occultism with Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah, I mean, Epstein was into this whole thing at MIT, this transhumanism.
Yeah, so he was involved in transhumanism, all kinds of strange, very edgy ideas of evolutionary ideas. The Santa Fe Foundation has like one of the obelisks or whatever, the big black things from 2001 A Space Odyssey, like one of these monoliths in it. So he's connected with a lot of these people. The girl who was one of, like, she wrote her autobiography, Giuffre, who's suing Dershowitz right now. In her autobiography, she said that In his Manhattan mansion, he had a secret passageway that had a statue of Pan. So Pan is this kind of, old ancient Greek god, but also a symbol of, Satanism or the devil worship. So, and if you look at his stuff, if you look at his little St. James Island, he's got this blue and gold temple. There's all
kinds that weird temple with that dome. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I don't know if we'll ever know the real story, but as far as like what the elite is really up to, I think that gives an insight, because I truly believe that Maxwell and Epstein were really very well networked, especially in Hollywood. And nobody in Hollywood wants to talk about it. If you look at those flight logs, it involves tons of people, late night talk show hosts, the elite. So I really do think that the elite were very brought in, and there's very good reporting from a website called Crazy Days and Nights that talked about all the people who would secretly go to that island. They would either take a boat, so there was no flight logs, and it was kind of it was almost like a Hellfire Club. If you remember the Hellfire Club, which Benjamin Franklin was involved in outside of London. You had this huge, powerful empire, and the king, the head of the exchequer, you know, very important figure, was having these crazy bacchanalia, satanic things going on in some weird cavern far away from everybody else, where they brought victims in and brought prostitutes in and alcohol. And I think Little St. James was really a modern day version of a Hellfire Club.
It's been kind of a, something that's been discussed by conservative talk show hosts for years. Now, all of a sudden, you know, there's some discovery, but it's too late because he's dead. So
there was a lot of people who breathed a sigh of relief when he passed away. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And speaking of late night talk shows, there is I don't know if this is true either. I'm wondering if you ever thought about it. My understanding is that President Trump has very vigorously prosecuted this, you know, child porn and child trafficking and pedophilia. That generally speaking, for the past maybe 20 years, the successive administrations have had an average of maybe 200 convictions a year. Under Trump, it's gone up to 2,000 a year.
Wow.
And that this might explain, and I'm not saying it does, but it might explain this utterly irrational hatred that some of these late night talk show hosts have, and I'm not mentioning names, for President Trump. Because President Trump is zeroing in on them. What do you think?
Well, I do think it's pretty remarkable that Epstein and Maxwell both got arrested under Trump. So the Trump administration's era, you can see all these Backpage was shut down, which was a horror show of human trafficking and underage trafficking and stuff like that. And it looks like all these guys, like they were all blackmailing each other. They were all involved in this stuff. So I would say that that may be one of the elements of Trump that might be doing good. He and Epstein go back to the 90s.
Yeah, we don't know what's going on with that. I mean, yeah, this thing is so incestuous and so massive that we'll probably never get to the bottom of it because everybody has a little something in it.
Yeah, I would say I mean, just by looking at those flight logs, that those are just showing there was a whole nother plane where the pilot didn't even keep flight logs. So these guys, you don't really know the totality of it, and they're all going to keep it secret to the grave, like they probably should.
What about Stanley Kubrick?
Well, we can go into Kubrick. I mean, I think Kubrick and Clark were both very much more into the occult than people would ever think. I covered Clark in my book, Children of the Beast, because he knew all the kind of occult numerology, the 1177, all this stuff.
And I think Kubrick was blowing the whistle on it in Eyes Wide Shut.
For sure. I think for sure. And I think I can't verify this thing, but Nicole Kimben said that Kubrick told her that the ruling class of the world binded itself together through pedophilia. And if you look at the whole thing, if you really watch Eyes Wide Shut closely, it's not just about a magical sex party at a Rothschild-owned mansion. There's definitely an undercurrent. I mean, at the very end, their kid walks off with two people who were at the mansion at the very, very first part of the party, and it says a magic circle. There's all kinds of really crazy stuff.
And a lot of the footage of that movie has never been made public.
Right, and that's not even the version that he edited, is my understanding. Exactly. I said his version. So they caused a huge kerfluffle, I think. I can't remember which production company did it, but there were very important movies that were made in 1999. That was one of them. The other is The Ninth Gate with Depp, who ties into West Memphis 3 again. Heavy duty satanic stuff with one of Crowley's rituals at the end, which is the marriage of the Beast and the Scarlet Woman. Is that basically reenacted right there, right out of a heavy duty satanic ritual that the public would never really know, but it's not even symbolized. It's reenacted. And that's really Johnny Depp's character passes through the Ninth Gate. And actually attains this kind of like satanic divinity or something like that. But yeah, Kubrick, I mean, if you look at Kubrick, there's been rumors about him when he did Lolita, which was pretty daring, that he was having a relationship with this 14, 15-year-old girl, that was the story about him and her, and Sellers was involved in that. So these guys, and it's very interesting, there's symbolism that was in Lolita that you see at Comet Ping Pong, where it's a ping pong place. But one of the key scenes between Humbert and Sellers' character is they're playing ping pong with each other. So you can kind of see this ping pong symbolism through Kubrick to kind of Pizzagate and all this stuff. But
yeah, plus that had like the symbol of pedophilia as part of their logo.
Right. Clark himself, you know, Clark,
this kind of like strange squiggly thing.
Right,
which
that
goes
circle,
way
right.
Back.
No, I know what you're talking about. But
and they changed that, by the way. You know, once the thing went public, I mean, they got rid of it.
Right, and they changed some other restaurants around that area. But you know that Clark ran a ping pong place in Sri Lanka where he would predate, or he was a predator for little, 14, 13-year-old boys. So these guys have a tie to this ping pong symbolism.
And it's something that's all over the world. And it's you know, I think Epstein is the tip of that iceberg. He had connections to sex parties in Italy and in other countries around the world. And we're never going to get to the bottom of that one. I mean, it's just, you know, we're playing, they control the high ground.
No question. But, you know, his black book is very telling. There's very old family money. There's very powerful clubs in Switzerland. The public has no idea exist. There's just incredible contacts and multiple names, Trump family as well. You know, Trump and Clinton and all these numbers, they have personal numbers for all these guys. So these guys,
they're all in it.
It's definitely kind of like an Eyes Wide Shut class that the public, the workaday, you know, pay rent, pay my car payment public has no idea about.
I know, and it's happening right in front of our eyes. Anyways, William, but you're a great researcher, and we could talk forever. I mean, I'll have you back to do some more digging into this subject, and I'm glad to have had the chance to talk to you today.
Likewise, it's great to be with you as well. It's great to have a host that's so well-informed.
Thank you. Where do people get your books, William?
You can find it at Amazon. My website, if you want signed copies, is WilliamRamseyInvestigates.com. I've got some articles on there that I've written in the past, some that have been included or in my books. But I'm also on Amazon. And my podcast is William Ramsey Investigates. I've done, talked to book writers and parapolitics.
Where do you hear the podcast?
Well, it can be anywhere, like iTunes, Google Play, I think. So it's William Ramsey Investigates, the title.
Great. All right, William, thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, talk soon. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.